Fox spoke to her in Russian and told her to come out into the hall. She was led towards the elevator, while Fox and Hines walked silently behind her and the gunman. The rhythmic echoes of footsteps in the big university building's hallways reverberated, and the elevator down loomed closer with every step. She wondered if there was anything she could have said to her father that would have prevented him from shipping her back to Russia, where, despite his assurances, she knew she faced certain death. She could have begged him, pleaded for a chance to work with him, but her pride prevented it. She was going to die in a gulag or be assassinated walking to the grocery if she didn't find a way to get away from these men before she was handed over to SVR. As the group approached the elevator, it surprised everyone when it dinged to indicate a car arriving on the floor. The armed men stopped and looked back to Fox, and Fox immediately reached for his radio to see who was coming. The doors began to open, and everyone reached for their weapons. Hines moved in front of Fox, pushing the smaller man back. "The girl," Fox said, and the Englishman grabbed Zoya by her shirt and yanked her onto her heels and back behind him as well. As the door opened, the carnage was immediately apparent. Two dead men were lying one on top of the other on the floor of the car. Blood splattered the walls and drenched the carpet below them. Zoya recognized both men as Bratva soldiers who had been guarding the stairwell and the elevator when she'd arrived. "What the fuck?" one of the Bratva men said, his MP5K up at his shoulder and scanning left and right. The men around him did the same. No one advanced on the elevator, and soon the door closed again. Fox brought the radio to his mouth and ordered all the men still alive in the building to be on the lookout. He sent three of the five men who had been guarding Janice Wan downstairs to immediately head to the rear stairwell to meet this group on the top floor. They would descend the rest of the way together, all the way down to the parking garage. Zoya complied in silence, but inside she was telling herself two things. One, she needed to find an opportunity in this moment of chaos to get away. And two, Court had come for her. Court had made his way to the second floor after killing the two guards and dumping them in the elevator, then pushing the button for the top floor and leaping out. He didn't know who would find them, but he did know that once they were found, it would create a moment of chaos that he wanted to exploit. And he didn't have to wait long for an opportunity. When the frantic radio call came over the walkie-talkie he'd taken from a dead guard, he understood enough of the Russian to recognize that the principals, whoever they were, would be descending from the top floor via a staircase at the back of the building. Court raced through a hallway past one laboratory after another, his Glock's silencer shifting left to right to cover all the angles as he moved. Two men came out of a doorway on Court's right. He fired one round into each man's head, then shifted aim to a third figure, moving just behind them. At first, he thought he was looking at a child, but quickly realized it was an Asian woman in her 30s or 40s, her black hair tied severely back, and her tiny frame covered in a white lab coat. She held no weapon, just stared at Court with uncomprehending eyes. "You're interesting," Court said. "You're coming with." And he pulled her into the well-lit hallway, past the two dead bodies, and he shoved her up against the wall. He began running his free hand all over her body while he pressed the suppressor to the back of her head.
"English?"
he asked while frisking her. He pulled a phone from her back pocket and slipped it into his. He left no inch of her body untouched, taking no chances that she might have a gun or a blade stashed somewhere. Her body began to shake uncontrollably, and for an instant, he thought she was having a seizure from panic. But when she didn't answer him, he repeated himself.
"English?"
He put his hand in the crotch of her slacks and pressed up, almost lifting her off the ground in the process of searching her. She shut her eyes tight and slammed her forehead against the wall.
"Stop it!"
"Cool," he said. "You do speak English, which means you and I can have a chit-chat. Where's the Russian woman being held?"
He knelt and felt over her quivering legs. She didn't answer him, even when he stood back up and spun her around to face him. Her pupils were all but dilated now. She looked to Court like someone with a preternatural fear of sharks finding herself surrounded by great whites in an ink-black ocean. He realized his hand was wrapped around her throat, and he was just holding her in place, not clamping down.
He detected some sort of aversion to touch, but just as he was about to use this to get her to talk, the elevator 50 feet down the hall dinged, and Court immediately dropped to the floor amid the two dead guards he'd shot a minute earlier. The woman stared down at him in shock and confusion, and Court said, "Raise your hands."
"What?"
He twitched the pistol in his right hand so she'd notice it. "I said raise your hands." She did so. "You say a single word and I shoot you first." He lay flat, his legs draped across the bodies there, his right arm outstretched with his pistol in it, pointing at the elevator, his captive standing above him. Janice Wan was frozen in fright, fighting waves of nausea she'd never felt in her life. But she did manage to turn her head towards the elevator. Two Russian mafia men carrying rifles came out. One went to the left wall of the hallway, the other to the right. They saw her immediately and held her at gunpoint. They both knew the scientist and were aware she spoke Russian, so one called out to her,
"What happened?"
Juan did not reply at first. Below her, she heard the man whisper,
"Быть осторожен, я говорю по-русски."
"Be careful, I speak Russian." The crazed gunman played dead at her feet, and she knew if she made any utterance of this fact, any gesture, to the two security men, then he would just shoot her as he'd shot the two others with her. She called to the Russians.
"A man shot these three, then went up the stairs."
Both men rose, lowered their guns, and began running forward towards the stairs behind where Juan stood. They made it less than 10 feet before Court sat up suddenly and shot them both twice in the chest. The two men fell dead, still 30 feet from where Juan stood. Juan saw the gunman struggle to get back up to his feet, as if he had a problem with his back and shoulder. But soon he was with her, turning her roughly up the hallway, away from the rear stairs. Zoya Zakharova descended the rear stairs, surrounded by muscular men. She was behind Fox and Hines and in front of 5 Bratva foot soldiers now, all moving at speed to get the hell out of there. The circular stairwell was open in the middle, and glancing down, she could see all the way to the ground floor, some 50 feet down. She knew there would be more Russians down in the parking garage waiting for them in vehicles. And although her chances for escape now were not good, they would only get worse once she had more men around her to deal with. She slowed her descent. A man pushed her from behind, and she stopped on the stairs, spun around, and grabbed his arm. As she yanked him forward and off balance, he stumbled into Hines, who was only able to keep from falling by grabbing the railing. This was Zoya's chance. She put her own hand on the railing, kicked her legs over the side, and then spun back around to face the staircase as she let go, falling straight down. Chapter 52. She dropped one entire flight before landing on the balls of her feet right on the outer edge of a step, collapsing her body to absorb as much of the shock as possible, while also lowering the momentum of her fall. And then, before her body absorbed all the impact, she let her feet slide from the step. Her hands slammed on the railing and again on the step below to try to break her fall a little more, and then she dropped another story. This time she used her hands to grab onto the railing at the third floor, repeating the maneuver with her feet that had her just catching the edge of the stairs to slow herself. Still, her arms were wrenched nearly out of her shoulder sockets when her feet slipped off and she dangled there. Above her, she heard men racing down the circular stairs. They had been instructed by her father not to kill her, but that didn't mean one of them wouldn't go off mission and try to put a bullet in her during the heat of the chase. She slid her hands down the vertical bars of the railing and then quickly swung her legs in and dropped on the stairs. She found herself on the second-story landing, so she opened the door and started to run up the tiled hallway. She made it all of 30 feet before the door opened behind her. A voice shouted for her to stop, and a pistol cracked. Zoya ducked lower and kept running, but as she passed an open doorway, she ran right into a hand that reached out, grabbed her by the left arm, and swung her inside. Zoya spun back around to face her attacker, balled a fist and drew it back, then let it fly. Court Gentry caught Zoya's small but powerful fist in his hand, wincing with the pain of the impact.
"Hey, it's me. How many of them?"
The echoing footsteps of men running up the hall was cacophonous now.
"5, I think."
"Your dad is a fucking army.
You got another gun?
Negative, he said, then spun out into the hall and fired four times with his suppressed Glock 19, sending two men to the tile with wounds to their legs, and three more diving into other laboratories and offices. Hines and Fox were nowhere in sight. Zoya turned back around and saw that she was in a lab of some sort. A large fermentation tank took up the center of the room. She stepped to the side to look for another exit, and when she did so, she saw a small Asian woman in a lab coat sitting on the floor.
Who are you?
Zoya asked. The woman did not answer. She appeared to be in shock. Court leaned out the doorway with his gun up, looking for fresh targets. While doing so, he spoke back to Zoya.
She's with them, I think. You haven't seen her before?
Been locked in a room since I got here. Who is she?
Hell if I know.
Court turned and hefted the small Asian woman up by her left arm, then slung her around towards Zoya, who then all but caught the lady before she fell to the ground. Court said,
We're sure as hell going to keep her till we find out. I can hold off these guys if you can get her out a window and down to street level. There is a driver outside. Get her to the car.
What kind of car?
Zoya asked as she began running for the window, pulling the woman along with her.
Forgot to ask.
What?
Zoya shouted.
Just get her away from here. I'll find you on the street a few blocks east.
Zoya moved close to him and put her hand on his back.
Are you okay?
He just nodded, looking up the hallway again for threats. A hand reached around a doorframe, pointing a pistol. Court fired at it and missed, and the gun and the arm behind it retracted quickly. Zoya squeezed Court's shoulder, then turned to the woman in the white coat.
You're with me, bitch.
She pushed her towards an old plate glass window. Picking up a rolling chair, she threw it at the glass, shattering it, then kicked at the loose shards to make a hole safe to exit through. Behind her, Court fired his pistol till it locked open, then changed mags and fired a fresh round. Zack Hightower accessed the building through a ground floor window and found himself moving through a hallway. He arrived at a stairwell and began ascending, heard firing coming from the second floor, but took his time clearing his way up the stairs, worried about anyone above him. He encountered no hostiles, so when he arrived at the door, he knelt down on the floor, lifted his submachine gun, and reached up for the latch. As soon as he opened the door, he saw a man lying a third of the way up the hall, and he was bleeding out, trying and failing to hold his life's blood inside his leg. Another blood smear went across the tile and disappeared into an open doorway just 30 feet in front of Zack on the right. Gunfire boomed from this room, some of it fully automatic, and there were either two or three people shooting from this position. Quickly, however, Zack realized the fire wasn't directed his way. Another room, 20 feet up the hall from the first and on the opposite side, had slow, controlled pistol fire emanating from it. He understood the tactical situation quickly. A group of two or three men with automatic weapons and seemingly plenty of ammo were shooting at a single man with a pistol who was clearly trying to conserve his. In addition to the tactical situation, Zack correctly assessed the composition of the two forces. He pointed his gun at the door on the right and shouted to the man firing from the door farther on his left.
Six! Six! Do you copy?
The pistol fire stopped.
Who's asking? Who else calls you Six, dumbass?
Court's call sign on Hightower's ground branch team had been Sierra Six. It was virtually the only way Hightower ever referred to Court Gentry. An MP5K reached out from the door on the right and pointed in Zack's direction. He fired a four-round burst at it, striking the brick wall inches from the door frame and forcing the weapon back into cover.
Turn on your fucking comms!
Zack had been trying to communicate with Gentry since he'd arrived on scene, but he'd received no response. He figured it a safe bet he'd simply turned off his earpiece to get Brewer out of his head. While he waited, he looked out again in the hall and saw the man with the leg wound lying still. After a few seconds, a reply came through Zack's earpiece in Court's voice.
Whose side are you on in this one, Zack?
Hightower kept the holographic weapon sight of his MPX centered on the doorway to the right, but he shook his head with a little laugh.
That hurts my feelings, bro. Mommy sent me in here to help you achieve your objective. How many dudes you up against?
Three on your right, first door. One is wounded. I think the guy on the floor in the hall is down, but dead check him to be sure. I don't have an angle. and I don't have the ammo.
Without responding, Hightower shifted his subgun to the left and shot the man with the leg wound once in the top of the head.
Dead check complete, Hightower said. He's even deader now.
Court said, we're still missing Primakov and Hines. They might be in the building, so watch your six. Zack didn't know who the hell Hines was, but Primakov was the second name on the target list Brewer had given him.
What about Zakharov?
No joy, he's not here. I've recovered one hostage and one enemy. They're outside the building getting off the X now.
Again, one of the Russians reached out with his pistol and fired, sight unseen, towards Zack's position in the stairwell. Zack ducked tight against the wall and then fired a burst of rounds of his own in response.
Roger, Zack said.
He had a feeling Court was saying he'd saved Zakharov's daughter. He was certain Brewer would be displeased when she learned of this, especially because Court had failed to achieve the primary objective. Zack said,
What do you need to do to get out of here?
You have any frags?
Negative.
Smoke?
Negative.
Bangers?
Bangers were flashbang grenades.
That's a negative.
The fuck kind of rescue is this?
Zack shouted now.
The one you don't bitch about because I can keep their heads down while you bounce. Now what are you going to do?
Court said,
Best bet is the window here in the room with me. It's already broken out. I can shimmy down to ground level, but it's going to take some time. There's a doorway on the far side of this room that I think will get me to the front stairwell by the elevator. But with the angle these assholes have on me, there's no way I can make it across the room without getting hit.
No sweat. I'll keep them right where they are. You bug out, then I'll exfil down these stairs.
After changing magazines, Hightower said,
Move!
Moving,
Court shouted. Zack dumped round after round at the doorway with the Russians behind it. He didn't expect to get an angle on anyone in there unless they popped out from cover like idiots, but he knew he could keep their heads down for the next 30 seconds or so, and keep them right where they were hiding for even longer, giving Court a good chance to get away. Court ran for the laboratory window Zoya had exited from 2 minutes earlier, but as he neared the doorway on his right, he looked through it. This led to an open office, and on the far side of that was another doorway. From the layout of the building he'd noted so far, he thought it likely the front staircase and the elevator would be through that door. The stairs would lead him straight down to the underground parking garage, where he hoped to catch Fox before he made his escape. He ran with his Glock out in front of him, then neared the shut door, but just as he got there, it flew open, and Fox came bursting out at a sprint. 10 feet behind him, Hines ran down the circular stairs. Fox was as surprised to see Court as Court was to see him, but Hines just charged forward like a bull from a dozen feet away. Court saw Fox's silver semi-automatic pistol rising towards him, so he raised his weapon to shoot him, but the big man went airborne, diving on him lightning fast. Court tried to shift aim to the threat more dangerous than a pistol, but Hines collided with him, slamming Court against the wall as if he'd been hit by a truck. Court's weapon flipped out of his hand and clanged down the circular stairs. With the wind knocked out of him, he fell to the ground, and Hines fell on top of him. Court now knew better than to fight the big man head-on, so he wrapped his arms and legs tight around him, attempting to use his knowledge of judo and Krav Maga against the pure boxer. Fox tried to aim at Court, but Court shifted his body to position it behind the brick wall that was Hines's torso. The Englishman shouted to his protectee as he wrestled on the ground.
I got this wanker sorted. Get to the car.
Fox ran down the stairs with the gun still in his hand. Hines struggled to get an arm free now. Court headbutted him in the forehead, but the man made no reaction to it at all, apart from headbutting him back. Court tried to shout for Zack, but his earpiece had fallen out with the collision. Hightower was 100 feet away and separated by multiple walls now, so there was no way for him to know what was going on. Court squeezed the big man tight while preparing to deliver another headbutt, but by brute strength, Hines was able to get an arm out of Court's clutches, then use it to push off on the floor and roll over. He made a complete revolution and slammed his 6-foot-9-inch frame up against Court, pinning him to the wall of the stairwell. Court's battered ribs hurt anew. He reached for the folding knife in his pocket, but just as he drew it, Hines punched Court's hand, and the unopened knife went flying through the doorway and 25 feet across the lab, banging against a plate glass window there and dropping to the floor. A punch to Court's jaw stunned him, but when Hines made it up to his knees, Court finally managed to land a blow of his own, a hard left jab into Hines's nose that knocked him onto his back on the landing between the two floors. But the huge man quickly got up, and Court used pure adrenaline to mask the pain in his body enough to push himself back on the tile to make some room to do the same. Hines touched his hand to his nose and looked down at the blood there. He shouted,
"Is that all you got?"
Court spit a mouthful of blood.
"No."
He leapt up to a crouch, lunged forward, slipped under a right hook, and came back up to deliver a spear hand to Hines's throat. But before it landed, he was caught by a left jab that knocked him back down. He hit hard on his back. The wind that was only just returning to his lungs seemed to disappear again. Hines laughed now, a wild look on his bloody face. Court used the wall to pull himself yet again to his feet, understanding that Hines was toying with him now. He moved forward and threw blows at the Englishman, but this was an act of futility. Hines had 10 inches of reach on Court, and the skill to keep his opponent from closing the distance. Finally, Court got under an incoming punch, shoved forward, and slammed Hines into the wall. He could hear the man groan in real pain now, and he followed with a kick to his knee. He connected, but Hines barely reacted, instead sending a chop onto the side of Court's already bruised and battered neck, causing him to fall back to the ground in agony. Court rolled onto his side, then slowly started climbing back to his knees. He moved much slower now than the last time he got up. Hines shouted above him,
"How about now? Is that all you got?"
"Not quite,"
Court mumbled, then spit more blood and added softly,
"But we're getting there."
Hines grabbed Court by his shoulders when he stood, yanked him back around, and put him in a headlock from behind. As he did so, he spoke into Court's ear.
"You're a goer, aren't you? I like your heart, mate. But a job's a job, and it's time to snap your fucking neck."
Court's right leg kicked up, back, and then down, trying to strike the inside of the boxer's knee to buckle and break the joint, but he wasn't able to find either of the man's legs. Hines was so tall that he was able to keep Court in a headlock without exposing his body to Court's counterstrikes. Court wrestled halfway out of the headlock when Hines tried to shake him like a rag doll to snap his neck, and then Court kicked his feet out in front of him, walked them up the wall, shoved off with all his might, and drove the boxer back, knocking him to the floor at the edge of the stairs. They both lay flat and still for a moment. Hines was wounded. Court was worse. Slowly, Court rolled to his side. He saw that Hines was moving slower now, too, but the Englishman used the railing to pull himself to his feet and was the first to stand. Amid true pain and fatigue that Court didn't see in his first encounter with the man, Hines stood fully erect and balled his fists. Blood drained from a cut on his left eyebrow as well as the continuing trickle out of his nose. Still, Hines grinned through the blood.
"That? Is that all you got?"
Court climbed to his knees, then up to his feet. He crouched, looking like he was going to charge yet again, but through gasps for air, he said,
"Yup, that's it."
And then he turned to his left and began running out of the stairwell and into the lab with a plate glass window just 20 feet away. Diving out the window would subject him to a fall of 15 feet or so, but at the moment, he thought it was his most prudent course of action. His energy was quickly depleting, and that meant Hines was seconds away from making good on his promise to break Court's neck. Court dove headfirst through the glass. It exploded around him easily, causing him less immediate pain than any of the blows he'd received from Hines the past few days. But he was now sailing through the air, windmilling his arms and legs, trying to keep from falling headfirst. He kept his eyes closed for a moment because of all the shattered glass in the air around him. But after he'd fallen a few feet, he opened them just in time to see the hood of a small burgundy hatchback directly under him. He tightened into a ball, shifted to his left side, and slammed into the hood, crumpling it down to the engine. The wind was knocked out of him yet again, and he felt something crack in his left hand when it banged hard against the windshield. He screamed in fresh pain, then slid off the car and onto the concrete surface of a parking lot at the back of the building. Worried about Hines or someone else grabbing a gun and shooting him from a window, he pulled himself up the car and back to his feet, held his injured hand across his chest, and ran away, running poorly, but running for his life nonetheless. Chapter 53. Court made it around the side of the building towards the street out front, where he saw an armed man running in his direction. The man wore a beard, sideburns, and a short haircut, and it wasn't until he smiled that Court realized it was Zack. He was pleased to see that his former team leader was uninjured and carried a submachine gun slung around his neck. Zack said, "I've got a car across the street and down the stairs." The two of them ran through the traffic and made it to the other side, and here Court chanced a look back and saw three men rushing out of the building. One of the three was Hines. They were all armed, and they clearly saw where their prey had gone because they dashed out into the congested street to cross it. Court and Zack entered the narrow close and began descending a series of over 150 stairs. Above them, gunfire kicked off the stonework of the building on their right, and then it pounded to their left. Court shouted at Zack as he moved, "Get your driver out of his fucking vehicle and tell him to point a gun up the staircase. We need suppressive fire over our heads." Zack did this, and in seconds, Court could see a figure coming into view at the bottom of the stairs, still some 50 yards away. The man drew a handgun, and then he raised it. As Court descended as fast as his legs would take him, it looked to him as if the pistol in the distance was pointed right between his eyes.
"Can this fucker shoot?"
Court yelled to Zack, who was just a few feet behind on his left, trying himself to get his SIG pointed behind him to squeeze off a few rounds without slowing.
"Wouldn't count on it,"
he said as he gave up, realizing he had to concentrate fully on the steps at this speed.
"Great," muttered Court.
Just then, the man below opened fire. The first round struck the stairs 8 feet below where Court and Zack raced. They both slowed and crouched, but continued their descent, now as worried about the supposed Confederate trying to help them.
"Zack!"
Court yelled, admonishing his former team leader as if there was something he could do to improve the red-bearded man's aim. The man fired again, and this time he hit the wall 8 feet above and to the right of Court's head. Bits of stone rained down on him as he ran on. He looked back up to the man and realized it was Jason, the young case officer he'd met in London. Now the man just 40 yards down the staircase fired a controlled but constant string of fire. Court heard sounds zipping over his head, and he was satisfied Jason was starting to get the hang of it. All the fire from behind stopped immediately as the pursuers scrambled for any sort of cover in the narrow close. At 20 yards, Zack shouted out to Jason,
"Get in the car!"
The case officer ran off to his left, out of view, and as Court himself approached the turn, he shouted,
"I hope you backed it in!"
He turned the corner, slowed, and saw the nose of a Land Rover pointed right at him, facing a long, straight stretch of road.
"Good job, kid,"
he wheezed to himself, completely out of breath now. Zack and Court climbed into the Land Rover, Zack taking the front passenger seat and, as Jason stomped on the gas, Hightower began reloading his MPX. Right in front of them, two men with Kalashnikovs barreled down the stairs on the left and out into the street. They turned, saw the onrushing SUV, and made to raise their weapons. Zack was still reloading. Court had no gun in the back seat. Zack said,
"Run him down, Jason!"
The CIA officer started to swerve to miss the men, an automatic movement, but Zack grabbed the wheel and shifted it back to the left. Jason recovered quickly and, at 50 miles an hour and accelerating, he slammed into both men in the street, crumpling the hood of the Land Rover and spiderwebbing the windshield as an AK slammed into it. But the airbags did not deploy. Zack slapped Jason on the back roughly.
"Attaboy! And you even thought to disable the airbags, too. Damn fine work for a rookie, kid."
Court caught a glance at Jason through the rearview mirror. The kid looked like he was about to have a heart attack. Court reached up and squeezed the young man's shoulder.
"Relax, Red. Just breathe and drive. We're good."
Court directed him to the east, and seconds later he saw Zoya and the Asian woman moving purposefully up the street amid a crowd panicking about all the gunfire emanating from just a couple of blocks away.
Stop!
Jason stomped on the brake pedal, the Land Rover squealed to a halt, and Court opened the back door. Zoya pushed the woman forward, right in front of astonished passers-by. The white SUV squealed again as the driver floored it. Zoya grabbed a roll of electrician's tape in the door of the SUV, then spent several seconds binding the woman's hands behind her back. She put more tape all the way around her head, covering her mouth and hair at the neckline. Then, with wild eyes and in a rushed and fluid motion, she grabbed Court by the back of the neck. She pushed him back against the side door, put her entire body on him, and kissed him deeply. Court's fight-or-flight reflexes spun in confusion, but within a few seconds, he kissed her back, aware simultaneously that the adrenaline coursing through his body now was having a nearly complete pain-killing effect on all his injuries of the past 48 hours.
"That's not going to last long,"
he told himself. When she finally pulled off him, she said, "Thank you." He saw his own blood streaked on her face. In the front passenger seat, Zack's head was craned all the way towards the action in the back. He said,
"So, yeah, I was there too, so..."
Zoya glanced his way quickly.
"Thank you, sir," she said, then turned her attention back to the man next to her.
Zack muttered to himself as he turned back around to the front.
"You're welcome. Not exactly the same as what he got, but you're welcome."
When Zoya pulled back away after kissing Court again, he looked down at his left hand. The back of it was deep purple, and it was swollen at the wrist.
"Shit," he said. "This is broken." "Shooting hand?" Zack asked. "Negative." "Don't need it. Carry on," he replied matter-of-factly.
Jason directed Zoya to a medical kit in the back of the Rover. From it, she pulled a chemical cold compress that she activated by breaking a capsule inside a plastic bag. Almost instantly, the 8-inch by 6-inch compress whitened with frost. She put it on the back of Court's hand, then began wrapping it with an ace bandage. Looking him over, she said,
"I see you met your big friend again."
"I did."
"How did it go this time?"
"How do I look?"
"Not good."
"Then you have your answer."
She adjusted the compress.
"Well, you got at least one solid hit in."
Court realized she assumed he'd broken a bone in his hand while hitting Hines. He sighed and laid his head back on the headrest.
"This happened when I punched out a totally innocent windshield."
They drove back to the safe house in near silence as everyone worked on fighting the effects of adrenaline and the onset of exhaustion. Even Jason was too amped up to talk. Chapter 54. Jason pulled the Land Rover into the detached garage of the farm west of Edinburgh, then helped Gentry out of the back. Court's body was besieged with pain. Even walking was difficult, and he warned them it was going to take him some time. Jason then took the prisoner out of the vehicle and guided her by the arm to the house, and Zoya rushed forward to get another ice bath prepped for Court. This left Zack to get under Court's right arm and help him walk up the long drive. As they moved slowly, Zack looked at Court, regarding his black eye, cut nose, and fat lip, and the purple-gray discoloration along his jawline.
"I just want you to know I respect your ability to maintain your cover identity as a punching bag."
"Thanks," Court said through gritted teeth.
Then, "This dude was unreal, Zack."
"A human did that to you? I thought you'd lost a fight with a trash compactor."
"Superhuman, like nothing I've ever faced."
Zack spit on the gravel.
"Whatever. I'll kick his ass for you next time we see him."
Court ignored the bluster. After a few more steps, Hightower said,
"That's Sakharov's daughter? She doesn't sound Russian."
Court shuffled along slowly with Zack's help.
"She's got a thing with accents. She's hot. Tell me she's with us."
"She's with us."
Court glanced to Zack.
"I think. Brewer said your mission was the dad. He's cooking up something nasty. Saving the chick was just personal."
"She's good, man. We needed to get her back. I did the right thing."
"Maybe we'll get some downtime tonight. You're beat to shit. So the only two dudes here able to give her any attention are me and that goofy-looking case officer. I like my chances."
He laughed to himself as they neared the front porch.
"Never did a Russian.
Wonder if she smells like caviar or borscht.
Court pulled up, causing Zack to stop.
What?
Hightower said. When Court did not respond, Zack's jaw dropped.
Wait. Six. You hitting that?
Court didn't answer, just closed his eyes as the pain came in waves.
You're hitting the fucking Russian chick. You are, aren't you?
Zack, no, I'm not.
Hightower laughed, then started pulling on Court again, helping him with each step.
You are totally banging Marina Oswald. Hot damn. Good for you. Honestly, didn't know you liked girls.
Court's body told him he'd be pissing blood for a week now, but despite himself, he laughed. They made it into the house. Zoya shepherded Court to the bathroom, where she'd already filled the tub with two bags of ice from the freezer and turned it on cold. Jason secured the mystery woman with metal cuffs around a bedpost in the back bedroom, and now he pulled security at the front window with a Benelli shotgun and his Glock. Zoya helped Court out of his clothes, stripping him down to his underwear as he'd done himself in London.
Zack stood in the doorway looking on.
I always go commando, personally.
Zoya glanced over her shoulder with annoyance.
Who's this charmer, Court?
She helped Court into the bathtub, slower than last time. As he sat down, he said,
Zack, Zoya, Zoya, Zack.
Zack said,
So, what, your agency?
She looked to Court, who shrugged back as if to say to her,
Feeling that question is your problem.
More or less.
Zack turned to Court.
You're kind of girl, Six.
She added,
And Fyodor Zakharov is my father.
Yeah, that I heard. You're an American spook with a GRU general for a dad? How the hell does that happen?
I'm Russian, former SVR.
Holy shit. So, you gonna play the sweet girl from Nebraska act till we let our guard down so you can knife us in the back?
I'm on your side.
Yeah, so is Marty Wheeler.
Court said, Who the hell is Marty Wheeler?
Zack laughed. While you two have been vacationing over here, I was back in the States on a mole hunt. Tracked the assistant DDS to London, ID'd him as the mole, and bagged and tagged him for old Matt Hanley.
Court said, Never heard of him.
Yeah, well, Wheeler almost got your ass killed more than once.
He turned to Zoya.
So, in light of recent events, I'm not in a super trusting mood at the moment.
Court said, She's with us, Zack. End of discussion. But Hightower kept at the woman.
I'm going to keep my eyes on you, sister.
He looked her up and down.
I mean, I would even if I didn't suspect you were an asset for the Oppo, but now that I have my doubts, you're really going to get watched over.
Zoya wasn't interested in this conversation at all.
Do what you have to do, but stay out of my way.
Zack raised an eyebrow at Court, who just shrugged. Jason leaned into the bathroom and looked down at the bruised and broken asset in the ice bath.
Sir, you need some painkillers?
Court thought about it.
What do you got?
Everything from Tylenol to morphine.
Something in the middle would be nice.
Jason retrieved the medical bag from the closet off the living room and began going through it.
20 milligrams of hydrocodone?
Looking at all those contusions, I don't think it will do more than take the edge off. It won't get you too high.
Court winced with the cold engulfing him now.
10 milligrams.
Suit yourself, Jason said, and he pulled out a pill. Court swallowed it with a beer Zack brought from the fridge, then winced again as he put the beer down next to the tub. He looked back to Jason and said,
Let's make it 15.
The young man broke a tablet in half and Court drank it down with another swig of beer.
He held up his hand, the compress was still on it, but he was able to see the swelling around it. He dropped it back into the ice water.
Zoya turned to the two Americans. Guys, he's going to need 15 minutes in the ice. Is somebody going to call Brewer in the meantime?
Zack took the hint and headed towards the back of the farmhouse. He leaned into the back bedroom to snap a digital image of the shackled woman lying on the bed, then stepped into the living room and made the call, sending the image to Brewer in the process to see if she could ID her. Brewer told Zack she'd just landed in Edinburgh and would call him back. And then Zack returned as Zoya helped Court change into jeans and a t-shirt she'd found in a guest bedroom closet in the safe house. All three of them then went into the living room. Zoya passed around beer, and they opened the cans. Jason stood by the window looking out, gun on his hip.
Court was feeling the hydrocodone take effect, improving both his pain level and his mood.
What's your dad up to, Zoya?
I still don't know, she admitted. He had a group of Russian mob with him and whoever the hell that lady in the lab coat is. He admitted to me he was about to make his play, but he didn't tell me what it was.
Court said, Belyakov told me it's some sort of retributive strike, totally unsanctioned. I think it might be related to the Five Eyes conference here.
Zoya sat up straighter. The Five Eyes annual meeting is here in the UK? Now?
In Scotland, even, Court said. Everybody senior at Langley will be there, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. Intel and counter-intel sections of FBI, DIA, NSA, all there. Plus the Brits, Aussies, New Zealanders, and Canadian intelligence and counterintelligence.
Where is it?
Near Loch Ness. They've rented out some swanky castle for the venue.
Zoya stood and paced animatedly. That's it. That's got to be it. They have to cancel it.
Court said, they won't cancel it, and Hanley won't pass intel to the Brits unless we have enough to wrap the whole thing up. Zack might have caught our mole, but the Brits think they have one, or more than one. We need to know what the plan is. Bomb it? Security will be insane. It would be tough to get in deep enough to do enough damage.
Zack fielded a call back from Brewer, going into a back room to do so. When he returned, he said,
Look alive, kids. Brass is inbound.
Court immediately started pulling himself up to his feet, but Zoya didn't understand. What does that mean?
Brewer is 10 minutes out, Zack explained.
Suzanne Brewer arrived in a rented BMW 3 Series. Behind the wheel was Chris Travers, one of the ground branch men from Walt Jenner's team. Hanley had sent him along for her security, while Hanley and the 7 other Special Activities Division operators got back in the air and flew on to Inverness, the closest airport to Castle Enric. Travers parked in the driveway and walked up the hill to the house, where they were met at the front door by Jason. In the living room, Brewer saw the 3 assets and immediately noted Violator's bruised face and the ice pack on his left hand. She made no mention of it, but Travers said,
Damn, Violator, I'd hate to see the other guy.
Court shrugged. Me too. 2 ass kickings was enough for me.
Travers laughed at this. Brewer looked at Jason, then jerked her thumb at the front door. The young case officer left compliantly. Now Brewer looked at Zoya like a teacher regarding a misbehaving student.
I have a lot of questions for you, Brewer said. You were in captivity for a day. Did you learn anything during that time that could help us determine what's going on?
Zoya nodded.
David Mars is my father, General Fyodor Zakharov. He is working against the West because he thinks MI6 killed my mom and my brother, and he thought the CIA had killed me. So, did they?
Zoya blinked.
I'm sitting right here. Brewer said, I'm talking about your mother and your brother, obviously. I don't know, but I have my doubts. My dad moved to London under an assumed name and started operating in Russia's interests, all part of Russia's strategy of indirect warfare. But I think he's been plotting his personal revenge all this time, too. He's not working for GRU, not working for the Kremlin per se. He was probably sent over here by the president and his billionaire cronies, but whatever he's doing right now, it's his own plan. No one else's. He's an independent puppeteer, carrying all this out on foreign soil. Maybe the British really did drive him to this, but you know the Kremlin and its schemes. Perhaps they were the ones who killed Fyo and Mom, to stoke his fury, to place him like a ticking bomb in the middle of their adversary.
Brewer said,
Well, the woman you are holding here has already provided us with one clue. We easily matched her photograph. Her name is Janice Wan. She's a virologist. Until about 4 months ago, she was working for the European Center for Disease Prevention in Stockholm. She's from South Korea. I've sent a message to Seoul Station to try to get more information about her.
What did she do in Stockholm?
She is an expert on the weaponization of pneumonic plague.
Court muttered.
Well, shit.
Yeah.
Brewer said.
We have people looking into her trying to figure out her link to Zakharov.
Zoya said, My father has the context to get whoever he wants, and he has the motivation. He is convinced the British killed his wife and son, and he's positive you guys turned me from a valiant and loyal Russian spook to a dirty American operative. My father is a man of utter conviction. As long as he believes all that, he will attack,
and nothing will stop him but a bullet to the brain.
You're playing my tune, sister, Zack said, and Zoya just gave him an eat-shit look.
Zoya then turned to Brewer. Now I have a question for you. What is poison apple?
Neither Zack nor Court had any idea what she was talking about, but to their surprise, Brewer said,
Where did you hear about that?
From my father. He doesn't know what it is either.
Brewer looked to Travers.
I need you to leave the room, please.
Ma'am, I'm TSCSI with a full-scope poly. I don't have to leave any room.
He was telling her he had the highest security clearance. She didn't blink.
I said I need you to leave the room.
Travers pushed himself off the wall.
Yes, ma'am.
He stepped out the front door and closed it behind him. Brewer looked back to the three in front of her.
I assume Wheeler got the name of the program somehow and passed it on without knowledge of its scope or sanction.
Court tightened a fresh cold pack on the back of his left hand and said, What is it?
Brewer said, It is you. You three make up an initiative that has been codenamed Poison Apple. It is approved by the director himself, and it is run by me, with the DDO determining the operations.
Court said, So what? We're Matt Hanley's private assassins? He expected pushback from Brewer, but she said,
That's exactly what you are. That, and spooks, surveillance artists, whatever he needs done that's blacker than black. Look, I don't like it, so don't bitch about it to me.
Court replied, I'm not bitching. Matt makes good decisions. He's a good man.
Zoya turned to him. I've seen good men attain power and abuse it.
Court waved his functioning hand in the air.
I've known Hanley for over a decade. I trust him.
Zack said,
The Ruski has a point, Six. Matt did order me to kill you once.
Court turned to Hightower.
You ordered your team to kill me, too. By that logic, I shouldn't trust you either.
Dude, I'm all you got.
He looked at Zoya.
Not her. She's trouble. I can feel it.
To Zoya, Brewer said, I'm going to talk to Matt. He has people he can call on the British IC, men who know where the bodies are buried. He might just be able to get someone to tell him what happened to your mom and your brother.
Zoya said,
I'd appreciate that, Suzanne.
Court said, What are we going to do about the Korean? Brewer said,
Frankly, I don't want to know what you do with her, but whatever it is, I need you to do it quickly.
She stood. Implicit in her comment was that she wanted the three off-book assets to get information from Janice Wan, and she had no desire to know the particulars of how they were going to go about it.
Zoya said, Now that we know this might involve a bioweapon, please tell me Five Eyes leadership is smart enough to call off the conference now.
Brewer shook her head.
It would make the Five Eyes look impotent if it got out there was some threat to the annual conference that presented itself the day before it began and they shut the whole thing down. These are intelligence agencies. They would be admitting they had poor intelligence. They'll increase security, I'm sure, but the show will go on.
She pointed to the back room where Juan was chained up.
What we need are answers.
She headed for the door now.
I'll be outside. Get her talking.
When Brewer left the room, the three poison apple assets stood together. Zoya looked to Court.
You want to do good cop, bad cop?
Court shook his head, then pointed at himself.
Bad cop.
He pointed at Zoya now.
Worse cop.
Then he turned and motioned to Zack.
Psycho cop.
Hightower and Zoya answered as one.
Got it.
And they sat down in the living room to go over their plan. Chapter 55. Castle Enric was stunningly beautiful, and Matthew Hanley assumed that when the sun rose the next morning he would find the Highlands to be equally breathtaking. He and his entourage of assistants and ground branch security men were led to a suite of guest rooms, and along the way Hanley stopped a dozen times to greet cohorts from other agencies already here for the three-day conference. Hanley had made a call while on the aircraft to Inverness and secured a meeting with one of the most senior and well-connected people in the UK's Secret Intelligence Service. Sir Robert Hawley was the number one man in the operational pecking order at Vauxhall Cross, the name given to the SIS's headquarters.
Holly had been a friend to the United States on many occasions, and while he wouldn't say a thing he wasn't allowed to say to any of the other Five Eyes organizations, Hanley had found him utterly candid and trustworthy in his actions before. They had reserved a small drawing room to speak in, and the counter-surveillance technicians were just finishing their sweep for bugs as Hanley stepped inside. Walt Jenner and Art Greer stood outside, while the rest of the GB unit walked the grounds to meet with the various security officials working the conference to coordinate movements. Sir Robert Holly was a handsome man, well into his 70s, perfectly dressed even late in the evening, and in possession of a blonde toupee that fooled no one. The men shook hands, pleasantries were exchanged, and a vetted member of the castle staff brought tea for them both. Hanley had no use for tea, but the Englishman poured himself a cup from the service and sipped it immediately.
"Right, so you said this was time-sensitive?"
"Very much so. It involves a potential threat to this conference."
"Good Lord," Holly said.
"Sounds like you need to talk to our security folks, not my department. But maybe I should take the opportunity to slip off to do some fishing. Here the rivers around here are full of perch and brown trout. Might be safer on a stream somewhere."
Hanley smiled at this. "We are working to get a handle on the situation. I need to talk to you, not security. I need information about an MI6 operation about 15 years ago.
The Englishman cocked his head.
"Well, then, the past is definitely my department. Go on."
"It's regarding an assassination."
Holly sat back in his chair.
"Iraq?"
Hanley shook his head.
"Moscow."
The intelligence chief said,
"I don't believe I have any information relating to that."
Hanley did not back down.
The victim was the son of the GRU chief at the time, General Zakharov.
Holly made a face, leaned forward, took his teacup, and held it to his mouth.
"His son?"
"Yes, Robert."
Before Holly took a sip, he said,
"Who's telling you we killed that boy?"
"His father."
Holly almost spilled his tea as he chuckled.
"Langley is quite behind the curve on that one, old boy. General Zakharov is long dead."
Hanley shook his head.
"We aren't the ones behind the curve at the moment. Zakharov has been in London for over a decade, Robert, operating under the alias David Mars."
"You're completely mental."
"Sorry, it's true."
"My God!"
Then he spoke softly.
"The Black Wolf.
He says you killed his wife and then killed his son."
Hanley did not mention Zoya and her defection to the United States. He was here to get information, not give it. Holly sipped tea in silence for nearly a minute. Hanley was rushed, but he knew his colleague would be weighing all the pros and cons about talking to the Americans about this subject. Finally, he said,
"Do I have your assurance that what I am about to say does not leave this room in any official capacity?"
"You have my word."
Holly nodded.
"Well, we bloody well did kill the wife. She was creating sleepers, long-term penetration agents, SVI assets to come into the UK to operate against us. A linguist, a native of England. She was good at her craft, and we saw no other way to stop her. Had a proxy from Belarus run her down on a Moscow street. Problem solved."
The erudite man gave a half-hearted shrug about the killing. He wasn't conflicted about it at all. Hanley nodded. He felt certain he would have given that kill order himself if he'd been in a position to do so.
"What about the kid?"
Holly shook his head.
"We didn't kill the boy. He died by accidentally exposing himself to polonium-226.
"How the hell did he do that?"
"We kept it all hidden. There was too much writing on Russian-British relations at the time to reveal our findings publicly. But our investigation concluded that young Zakharov was ferrying the isotope into the UK for his father. We didn't know General Zakharov was already here at the time, only sussed that out later. This was before Dagestan, mind you. He was mad about his wife's death and came up with his own plan to get revenge. His plan was to kill top intelligence officials with the polonium, and at the time, he knew we had assets in the Kremlin. He didn't have sanction, but he did have men and women in the intelligence services who owed him. He got the polonium and had it stabilized and processed for travel, but couldn't acquire someone who could get into and out of the UK without the chance they would be identified as GRU. So, he used his own son, under doctored papers, had him come to London. Poor sod had no idea what he was doing. The bloody polonium was in a chocolate bar, wrapped in foil made out of some material that prevented it from leaking out. The candy was given to the boy by a friend of the general, obviously an agent of the GRU, ostensibly as a gift for his old friend in the UK. Poor lad got hungry on the plane, I guess, ate some of the bar, and was sick within hours. Dead within days.
Hanley shook his head at the absurdity of it.
Holly said, "Not long after that, Zakharov turned up dead in Dagestan. We have the photos of his body."
Hanley shook his head.
"Doctored, we have multi-source confirmation."
"What sort of confirmation? What sources?"
"Sorry," Hanley said.
Holly let it go.
"If the father is alive, I am sure he knows it wasn't a British op at all. It was his own Russian op that went wobbly, because they didn't use a bloody trained courier to get the radioactive isotope into the British Isles. It was a tragedy for the young lad, no question. But I can tell you all of us in MI6 were bloody pleased that that bomb detonated prematurely, in a manner of speaking."
Hanley sat up, his hands on his knees.
"Well, now it seems Zakharov is working with a Korean expert in weaponized plagues."
Holly blinked hard.
"That fishing trip is looking more and more enticing. Fancy going with me, now?"
The understated English humor wasn't lost on Hanley, but he was already thinking about his next steps. He just looked off a moment.
Holly said, "What can we do? This is our country, not yours.
The penetration into the CIA, the one that got all those guys killed at Turnhill, was not some drunk in the mailroom, some dead-ender mid-level case officer who just wanted a houseboat. It was an assistant deputy director. If you have been penetrated as well, the last thing I want to do is share intel with the UK."
"I understand. We'll ferret out the tout sooner or later. For now, do what you have to do."
They both stood and shook hands.
Hanley said, "I appreciate the intel. Whenever you need something from us, you just shout."
"Oh, I've a bloody list, Matthew. Trust me. I'll come knocking for my own information. But first, do go out and save the bloody day."
David Mars sat at a table in the kitchen of the old Highlands Church at the top of the hill, within sight of the little airfield down in a valley hundreds of yards away. He stared across the table at Roger Fox. Fox and Hines had just arrived from Edinburgh, and although Fox had passed on the news of what happened at the laboratory to Mars while en route, he was now getting the third degree from the former GRU general in person.
Fox said, "Of course, it's very possible your daughter and Dr. Wan were killed during the attack or during their escape. It was a fluid situation, and we do not know,"
Mars barked back.
"I have people in the Edinburgh police. No reports of any female dead or injured at the scene."
Behind Mars, a pair of elite Russian mercenaries loomed ominously, Kalashnikovs hanging off their shoulders and their eyes on Hines, the only real threat in the room if the altercation between Fox and Mars got any more heated. Mars was the man paying their wage. They'd kill for him, and they'd kill to keep him alive.
Fox said, "This was not the outcome we wanted, David, but we can use it to our advantage."
Mars looked out the window towards the bottom of the hill. Slowly, he nodded.
"Wan didn't know the plan. She only knew what we told her. The fact that they have her in custody is problematic, but it won't alter our mission. If she talks, the Brits will just put tornadoes in the air and shoot down a plane we never put much stock in to begin with."
Fox said,
"Yes, and if she talks, then all the security men will be looking towards the sky, won't they? When the Five Eyes shoots down the crop duster, it will think it repelled a potentially devastating attack, and the 400 occupants of the castle will have no idea they only have days to live."
Mars said,
"There is one problem, though. Wan has been here. I had her blindfolded the last 20 minutes of the flight here, and she was blindfolded almost all the way to Castle Enric. We drove an extra hour so she couldn't judge distance. She can tell them about an old church on a hill, perhaps, but this is Scotland. There are thousands, and it could be anywhere in the Highlands.
Mars said, inform the team leader of the mercenaries that they need to be even more vigilant.
I'll check with my sources in MI5 and MI6, see if they are getting anything out of one.
Chapter 56. Suzanne Brewer called the safe house near Edinburgh just seconds before Court planned on beginning his grilling of the woman shackled in the bedroom, with the news that no one in South Korea had ever heard of Janice Wan. At this point, it was obvious to all that the woman in their custody was a DPRK asset. Court knew she would be trained to handle interrogation, but he knew that they had to get something out of her. He moved towards the back of the house, his body feeling much better with the opioids deadening a portion of his pain. He entered the bedroom alone, facing the woman. He could tell how upset she had been when he frisked her, and it told him she was uncomfortable with touch in general. To capitalize on this discomfort, he leaned close to her face, into her ear, his beard scratching her cheek.
Comfortable? She said nothing. You and I are going to have a little talk. If you don't give me what I want, you're going to be taken away to a black site and interrogated more forcefully. I think we'd both like to avoid that, if possible.
She had no reaction at all to this, so he steeled himself for some frustration. She'd be a tough nut to crack. Perhaps it would go all the way to Zack before she opened her mouth, and he caught himself almost feeling sorry for her for a fleeting instant. As expected, Court's role as bad cop in the interrogation of Dr. Janice Wan yielded no results at all, not a single word out of her mouth. He stepped through the door and tagged up with Zoya. Court had told Zoya that he'd heard Wan speaking Russian to the Bratva soldiers, so when Zoya entered the room, she did so impersonating an SVR officer. In shouted Russian, she told Wan that Russia did not sanction any of this, which she felt certain was true, and Zakharov's plan all along had been to frame her as the mastermind of the entire scheme, which she also assumed to be accurate. Zoya could see the enemy agent's mind thinking through everything she was being told, the first hint before someone cracks. Still, Wan gave up nothing. Zoya had seen this level of fanaticism before, both in Chechnya and the Middle East. Wan would gladly kill herself right now if she had any means to do so. She wasn't going to say a word. And then came Hightower. He entered the room with a toolbox taken from the garage, nonchalantly opened it, and began putting various tools on the nightstand next to the bed where the North Korean was shackled. A hammer, a saw, a hand drill, a vice grip. They were all rusty. He took his time doing this, never once speaking or glancing over to the woman while he prepared. Finally, he turned her way and stood over her.
I don't want to hurt you, he said, and then a few seconds later, he started laughing. Who am I kidding? I totally want to hurt you.
Janice Wan blinked. He turned serious in a heartbeat.
But I'm not supposed to. Rules. I'm sure you've got some of those where you come from, right? How many bugs can you eat on holiday so you can get some protein? How many prisoners can you do your biological testing on? Everybody's got a boss, and every boss has rules. You and me, we're no different.
He sat on the bed next to her, then leaned forward.
Except for the fact that my boss tells me I have to get you to talk, and my boss made me promise to never tell her what I did to make you talk. So, I guess we can say that what happens in this room stays in this room, Janice. Are you picking up what I'm putting down?
He saw a little tremble, a quickening of her heartbeat evident in the veins of her throat.
Zack picked up the saw, smiled. My coworkers usually don't let me anywhere near an interrogation. I had a couple of unfortunate experiences. But it's your lucky day, honey, because we've got the place all to ourselves.
He rolled up the sleeves of his denim shirt.
What do you say we get to know one another?
Zoya and Court sat out on the front porch with Travers and Jason. Brewer paced the darkness 20 yards away, talking into her phone, although no one knew who she was talking to.
A woman's scream came from the house, followed by the authoritative shouts of a former Navy SEAL and CIA paramilitary, followed by a long moment of silence. This was repeated over and over, but no one outside commented on it at all. Finally, Zoya reached over and put her hand on Court's back, gingerly. How are you feeling?
Better than her. Not much, maybe, but some.
She looked down at his hand. The ice was off it for now, but he'd get another icing in a few minutes. She said,
You know you can't operate with one hand, don't you? Whatever happens next, you'll need to stay out of it.
There was no way that was happening, Court knew, but now wasn't the time to argue. He just said,
What about you? At some point someone has to stop your father. I think you need to stay out of it, don't you?
Zoya looked off into space.
Suzanne says no one knows what this mole told my father, and we don't know what contacts he has in UK intel. But we know he doesn't know details of Poison Apple. That means it will probably have to be one of the three of us who takes him down.
Court looked to Travers, sitting next to him.
Hey, Chris, earmuffs.
Travers rolled his eyes.
Dude, full scope poly.
Court said,
Please.
Travers put his hands over his ears with a sigh and walked off into the dark, out of earshot. Jason just sat there. Court eyed him for a few seconds, then said,
Really, kid? You think you're cleared for any of this?
No, sir, he replied, and he walked off into the night as well. Sorry, Zoya said. I shouldn't have said poison apple.
Court shrugged.
Hell, the only reason we know about it is because the enemy told us. We didn't get it from our own side.
The enemy, Zoya repeated, then said, My father.
I'm sorry.
Why? You were right.
More screaming came from the house.
Court said, Yes, it will have to be one of us most likely that kills him, but it should not be you.
The argument died there, and Court had the feeling he'd won. They talked for a few minutes more before Zack came out, covered in sweat. He was animated, amped up, his eyes searching.
Where's Brewer? Get me Brewer!
Suzanne Brewer came walking out of the dark, disconnecting her call in the process.
What did you get?
Zack said,
8 liters of pneumonic plague weaponized in 4 aerosol delivery canisters, each the size of a commercial fire extinguisher. The target is Castle Enric, but she does not know the time of the attack. She said total casualties of a successful attack like this were upwards of 5,000 dead, most all of them IC members and their families.
Brewer closed her eyes.
Oh my God. Means of attack?
Would you believe a motherfucking crop duster?
Brewer smiled a little now and opened her eyes.
Not anymore, it's not. We'll put 20 helos and fast movers around that castle and blast anything bigger than a duck out of the fucking sky.
Brewer had spent years in CIA working on threats to agency personnel and facilities. She was more in her element now than she was running Sub Rosa assets by far. Zack said,
Zakharov and his mob bozos have a staging area up in the Highlands. She doesn't know where, although she was there a few weeks back. Within about 3 to 4 hours of the castle. I think we've just got to go look for it. There is a bright yellow crop duster away from any airfield. She said there is an old church and a graveyard.
Brewer bit her lip.
Might take some time, but I'll get people on that now.
Zoya turned to Zack.
You got all that out of her?